What have we got here? Cochineal, this amazing range of reds. Cochineal, A, with a tin and oxalic acid mordant. B, with an exhaust of the, which is the one where you pulled it out, you've got the most colour, mm-hmm. as you can see in there. Look at the intensity of that colour. And then this, as it were, the dirty bathwater, you know, when it wasn't quite so strong. And you're getting a wonderful subtle pink. And here you've got, and she's put down all the places that the, well, cochineal obviously wasn't a local grown plant. But here we are, another page, cochineal with a chrome mordant, with an iron mordant. Third dip with an alum mordant. And all of these, who could not respond to that colour? And so somebody who was having a sort of recuperative and enjoyable time, can you imagine being presented with this? Let's have a bit of fun with this colour. It is so beautiful. Look at the two lots of indigo. And here you are, Erica. Well, this is heather. So obviously they went out and got some heather. Lady's bedstraw with this glorious yellow. Here's a slightly darker yellow with rush flowers, again, which have been gathered from the field. And what else have we got? Bracken tips. These are very, very subtle sorts of colour. Green walnut, the whole fruit. You've got an amazing brown here. And then it looks different. And this is water lily root, and that looks different with two different mordants. And so you go on. Meadow sweet, another glorious yellow. And we go back to the cochineals again. And what are these? Indigo. And indigo with onion, with onion skins. Again, you've got the most beautiful range of yellows and browns. And here's another book. What's this? Elderflowers. Look at these beautiful, beautiful yellows and browns. Meadow sweet again. So, can you just imagine? I mean, I look at these and get hugely excited with them.
Bright water. Haloed a dandelion clock. She leans back, lets pink granite hold her, as warm as worn madder. The light shifting like lace in her hands says, the colours, how the weather comes in. The indigo water, the slow woven hills, the warp of bog myrtle, the weft of the heather. And colour is rapture. I picked up this pebble. And colour is rapture, all streaked with green marble. And colour is rapture, she says. Weld gives a pure bright yellow like disturbed soil. Someone called us once, said there were oceans of it beside the new road. Well, we hired a van, we piled it high. Nobody stopped us. We were new to dyeing then, wondered if we'd got the wrong plant. But when I washed my hands, the water ran yellow, and I knew.
The title of this audio publication and the exhibition that accompanies it comes in part from The Art of Swimming by Stephen Shaw, a book influenced by Alexander Technique Thinking. It appears in one of Margaret's notebooks, among dye recipes and observations, something she intended to return to, something she wanted to understand more fully. I found myself returning to it too. Unlike pigments, dyes are water soluble. They do not sit on the surface of a material, but move through it, passing into the fibres before becoming fixed. Water is not only a vehicle for colour, it is part of the process. It carries, disperses, suspends, transforms. The Alexander technique describes movement without unnecessary tension. A particular quality runs through it. Lightness, attention, economy of effort. The feeling of being supported rather than held. Dyeing works in this way. Colour emerges through relationship between fibre and water, plant or insect, heat time and movement. The dye does not impose colour so much as allow it to take place. Colour is often taken for granted. It fills the world quietly, shaping how we move through it and how we recognise things. It helps us distinguish, navigate, and survive. But it also exceeds use. Colour carries memory, emotion, and association. It slips beneath language before we have time to name it. Margaret and David's work with natural dyes was commercial and consistency mattered. Their archive shows how closely colour was observed and recorded. Every batch was tested and compared. In one sequence, labelled card number 14, shade 310, there are 9 skeins of madder dyed yarn laid out side by side. At first glance, they appear identical. Looking again, differences begin to emerge. Lot 14 is fractionally paler than the others. Lot 11, 12 and 19 are slightly richer. Across the whole sequence, the colours shift almost imperceptibly. These differences are small, but they mattered. Margaret's notebooks show a close attention to colour in process. Notes that a dye had begun to deepen too quickly, lifting the yarn from the bath while still wet, because experience told her how much darker it would dry. She was reading colour while it was still changing, making decisions in anticipation of what it would become. This was not only technical knowledge, it was a way of seeing that had been learned over time through repeated attention. In the archive, colour is never quite fixed. It shifts as it is recorded. It is something negotiated between water, fibre, dye and eye. What is recorded are not only colours, but the conditions for seeing them.
I do remember she would sort of paint samples from the landscape and pick flowers and things. She loved the effect of the heather and the gorse when they're out together and how you get the bronze. So she brought home samples, pieces of heather, pieces of gorse, and then matched the dyes to that.
Rose red. Carmine red with snow white and a very small portion of cochineal red. Peach blossom red. Lake red mixed with much white. Carmine red, the characteristic colour of Verna, composed of lake red with a little arterial blood red. Lake red, the crimson red of Verna, composed of arterial red with a portion of Berlin blue. Crimson red, carmine red mixed with a little indigo blue. Purple red, lake red mixed with a little carmine red and indigo blue. Arterial blood red, the standard crimson red of Verna, composed of carmine red with a little vermilion red. Dragon's blood red, arterial blood red mixed with a little chocolate red. Brick red, red mixed with a little brown and yellow. Tile red, red mixed with a little yellow and grey.
I wanted to explore the harmonics of one note. Mm. And so I looked as a visual sort of echo of that idea. I looked at the madder plant and all the colours that you could obtain from one basic plant. I mean, it's not an exact correlation, but it was near enough to be interesting. in that one musical note contains all its overtones. Mm. So the one madder also contains its overtones in the exhaust or the different mordants.
I think when I try to explain to people about the qualities of natural dyes, one of the things I say is that because it's from a plant, there will be a whole group of different colours within that dye. When you use a chemical dye, it will dye what it says on the packet. But if you look in a dye pot and you can pull out different colours from the different constituents in the plant, and I think that's what gives natural dyes their unique quality, is that the colour is a blend of all the things that are within the plant to give you a resulting colour, but it will have a different richness, I think, if you look at two skeins of yarn, one natural dyed and one synthetic dyed. You'll see a different quality in the colour.
Looking through Margaret and David's notebooks, it becomes difficult to separate colour from other forms of knowledge. David often approached this through comparison and example. In his notes from a talk at the Colour Congress at Iowa University in 2002, he describes a conversation about natural and synthetic dyes. In Rugs of the Peasants and Nomads of Anatolia, Dr. Bommer makes a detailed study of the phenomenon of a brash, the subtle variation in hand-dyed textiles, the harmony that comes from the complexity of the dye itself. In madder, for example, we are looking at 19 different dye pigments simultaneously. He continues, universities across Europe are building this technology. I have worked with one batch. The colours are beautiful, but inevitably they lack a brash. I asked the chemist how many dyes he had used in the madder extract. 2, he said, alizarin and pseudopurpurin. What about the other 17? I asked. Rubbish, he said. His thinking moves into herbalism. David Hoffman is a herbalist from California who published many books. After qualifying in the UK, his first practice was close to us in Wales, and we knew him well. He once said that many modern drugs are derived from herbs that often give better results. Herbs are slower, he said, but very effective. It is the other ingredients in the plant that deal with the side effects. The plant is the complete cure, David adds. I wonder if there is not a close analogy between obtaining dyes and medicines from herbs. The plant is also giving the complete dye. In his notes, colour moves easily between disciplines. Textiles, chemistry, medicine. As if each is a different way of describing the same material process. We began to notice something similar in our own dye work with local plants. Recipes sit alongside notes on other uses. Medicinal, toxic, practical. Onion skins are saved for dye baths, while onions themselves recur in herbal medicine. Willow carries its own histories of pain relief and fever treatment. The same plant shifts function depending on how it is prepared or understood. Colour, medicine and chemistry sit close here, not as separate fields, but as overlapping ways of working with plant material. This overlap extends into the history of synthetic dyes. In 1856, William Henry Perkin, then 18, and working at the Royal College of Chemistry in London, was attempting to synthesise quinine, a treatment for malaria. When he produced a purple substance instead, a failed experiment became the first commercially successful synthetic dye, mauvine. A search for medicine became a history of colour. From that point on, dyeing and pharmaceuticals remained closely linked. Many of the chemical companies that later came to dominate both industries Bea, Siba, Sandos, grew out of this shared field of research. Early work on synthetic dyes helped shape modern pharmaceutical science. Seen this way, colour has never been purely decorative. It sits alongside questions of health, toxicity, use, and transformation. Margaret and David's notebooks belong to the same lineage, although they sit outside it. Their recipes record an empirical understanding of plant chemistry, developed not in a laboratory, but through repetition, observation, and making.
And you know, madder was one of the main passions of David. So, you know, the story that it has healing properties, madder dyed wool, apparently. And the miners, they used to, when they had backache or something, they used to put this red flannel in, sort of to cover their back.
Mum, because of her background in nursing, sort of knew a bit about it. And she then went on later to research into madder and healing. And there is a tradition of madder-dyed cloth to put on to ease rheumatism.
Alongside its scientific and industrial histories, there is another way of speaking about colour, rooted in experience. The act of moving through colour can be restorative. I have seen this in my own practice, and in the volunteers we have worked with as part of this project, building a shared natural dye archive. Not in any formal sense of colour therapy, but in the way attention shifts when working directly with plant material, water and cloth. The slow uncertainty of it, the not knowing in advance. People working with natural dyes often describe a kind of colour psychology that sits between conscious and unconscious response. The way certain colours seem to affect mood, memory, or perception. Less a theory than an observation made over time. What has stayed with me is how often people respond to natural colour with unexpected intensity. It seems to exceed its material properties. Part of this lies in attention itself. Plant materials often begin as leaf green, chlorophyll, but what emerges in the dye bath is never fully known in advance. There is always the moment of waiting. There is also the slow work of learning to see differently, learning the names of plants, noticing what grows along hedgerows and field edges, paying attention to what is already there and so easily overlooked.
I think it was a love of the natural world. And so she would go, I remember when I was little, she would go out for walks and go and look at the sea and get the colours from the landscape and then figure out how to bring those back and put them into a tapestry. So it came from that place of being outside, and she always squealed, you know, if she saw bluebell wood or the colours of a hillside or a seascape, she would get super excited, and then that came out in some of her amazing designs. She used to talk about, I need to go out and look at some colour. I just sit and stare more and more. I just sit and stare at the landscape and try and soak it up and think about how it's affecting me emotionally and how my emotion affects how I'm looking at it.
I cannot imagine anything more wonderfully healing and positive than working with colour.
You can take a pause now or continue to the next chapter titled Alchemy and Innovation.